This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. What happens when humanity gains powers once reserved for the gods? From artificial intelligence and gene editing to radical life extension and space exploration, technological progress is accelerating at an astonishing pace. My guest today is Stephen Kotler. He's a best-selling author and leading expert on human performance. In his new book, We Are as Gods, co-written with Peter Diamandis, Kotler explores how we can navigate an age of unprecedented abundance and why our greatest challenge may not be technological, but deeply human. Stephen Kotler, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So you make a parallel in the book to miracles, you know, the kind of miracles talked about in the Bible. The Bible refers to miracles, and you suggest these are miracles that technology is now allowing. Could you give a concrete example before we move on?
Yes. You know, in the book, we talk about the work of Max Hodak and the Size Corporation, who has an implant that's coming on the market now. It's a implant that goes into your retina, it treats macular degeneration. That is a disease that impacts 170 million people worldwide. So that is a miracle of biblical proportion. Like, I don't know what, like, it's blindness at scale. You're curing blindness at scale. I don't know else what we call that, right? It's a miracle of biblical proportion. And in fact, when we did that analysis, in the book, you'll find 6 pages of godlike technology, single-spaced. The actual list was 12 pages long. I cut it in half. I cut like half of the miracles out because I was just like, I can't beat on my readers more than like 6 pages of single-spaced text. Like it wasn't fair to my reader, but it was really twice as long. It's an astounding place in history that brings, and I think this is our major point, an astounding amount of responsibility.
And for the non-reader of the Bible, this might be a really interesting place to start, is to capture these parallels. Because as we look at technology, the scarcity model, the abundance model, you know, we came when life was much simpler, when we were hunting down our meal and when we never ventured very far from home. We were in a scarcity model. I think you'd say this as well in the book, that we're still in a scarcity model in some ways when we become sort of feeling like we're victims of this very fast-moving AI, for example, that all of our jobs are going to go away. But if our brain is malleable, science has shown us it is more malleable than we ever thought, shouldn't we be able to transfer into an age of abundance where we view technology as something that allows us to unleash our creative minds?
Yes, and let me speak into it from two angles. Let me start with abundance, because I think it's worth talking about what do we mean by that term and what do the actual facts show us first, and then we can talk about our mindset, because the mismatch is kind of astounding. So when Peter Diamandis and I used the term abundance, it came from our 2012 book, and we said, hey, look, there are 10 technologies, they're accelerating on exponential growth curves, AI and robotics and biotech, et cetera, and they're soon going to give us the ability to meet and exceed all of the basic needs of everyone on the planet. That was what we saw coming, and people hated it. Like, they hated it, right? The Wall Street Journal, right? Like, a 2-page op-ed of how we were wrong, and Peter opened TED with this talking about abundance, and then the guy who immediately followed him was the exact opposite. Like, they put the doom and gloom guy right after Peter just to sort of make a point. And it's interesting because we open the book, even before you get to the book, with like 5 to 10 pages of quotes about abundance, people saying, oh, wow, we're in a world of abundance. And there are some numbers that are like worth sort of putting around it, because when we said it in 2010, it was a promise. It was coming. It's been 12 years, and just put a couple numbers around it. 200 million people escaped extreme poverty in the past 12 years. That's the largest poverty reduction gap in history. 1 billion people gained access to electricity. 2 billion gained access to clean drinking water. 7 billion people up from 1 billion to 8, gained access to computing and communications with a smartphone. And just to put a number around something which is crazy, if you take a 2010 smartphone and you measure what is called the value density is a fancy term for like all the stuff you get for free in your cell phone. You get a encyclopedia and a record player and maps and all that stuff. So that's value density. The average value density of like a 2010 smartphone was about $1.5 million in 1980s technology. So all the stuff you got for free, that was amazing. The value density of a current smartphone is $7.3 million. It means that like in access to like services and goods, 6 million people became multimillionaires over the past 12 years. This is also, by the way, there's a dark side to abundance. It's not all positive, right? We have an abundance of convenience. It's led to an abundance of plastic pollution in the ocean. We have an abundance of energy. It's led to an abundance of carbon in our atmosphere. We have an abundance of cheap food. It's led to an abundance of obesity. We have an abundance of AI, of smartness in our technology. It's led to, as you pointed out, an abundance of fears of technological unemployment. So there's a dark side that comes along with it. It's not all rosy, but your point is the second half of this, which is the human brain evolved in a local and linear environment. It doesn't do global, it doesn't do exponential, it basically doesn't do speed and scale. So we have old machinery that literally can't grok the modern world. And what's interesting, the one last thing I want to add here, because you mentioned it and it's so important. People are talking about AI as if it's a thing that's happening to them, right? The victim mindset around AI is sort of everywhere. I study human performance. There's two rules in human performance. You come to me and you want to train human performance. You want to get better. There's two things I have to ask you right off the bat. The first thing is, do you have enough money to pay your rent and your food and have a little left over? You don't need to be wealthy, but you have to be a little bit above baseline. Otherwise, there's too much fear in your nervous system and I can't actually train you. The second thing that I have to look for is, do you have what's known as an external locus of control, a victim mindset? I have no power here. The world is happening to me. I don't have any control. When you do that, the brain, which is always trying to save energy, it's an efficiency engine, always wants to conserve energy. The brain goes, oh, wow, you've got that challenge coming up, but you don't have any power here. You don't have any control over your future. I'm not even going to bother producing the energy to focus completely to even get into this fight. And so it will block, I work on flow predominantly, but like this will block motivation and creativity and resilience. It'll block flow too, but it's really crippling across the boards. And you also actually pointed to the solution, which is mindset is how you sort of frame the world, right? Frames are short-term, immediate mindset, sort of the middle ground's a little bit longer and more durable and robust. And then bias is basically unconscious at this point, right? But they're all sort of related. And you really want to start having an abundance mindset. And this is interesting because I think, like this comes up, I think, in work. I know most of the people I know work in and around the fields I work in. And people will come to me, right? And they're succeeding. And if you have a scarcity mindset, you think, oh shit, their success means I don't get mine, right? And I think that's almost an instinctive reaction that a lot of us still have, myself included, right? And I always want to remind myself, no, man, there's plenty of room at the top. Let's all get famous together or wealthy together. Whatever it is we want to get together, let's do it. Let's do it together. That's an abundance mindset. I really, truly believe it. But it's easy to get slip backwards. It's easy to catch yourself in various things and get really protective. And, oh, we have scarce resources. We have dwindling resources. And the other point, and we made this back in abundance, this is the miracle of technology. Whatever else you want to say about it, it's a resource liberating mechanism. Technology is how we make more resources. And that in itself sort of tells you that as technology evolves, we're moving towards a world of abundance since it's sort of built into the function of what technology does.
Yeah. Well, as you mentioned a few minutes ago about the $7.3 million of resource, what did you call it? Sorry.
Value density is the technical term.
Oh, yeah. Value density that is our smartphone. The wealth gap is increasing. in a big way. I mean, I would say in this country specifically. And is that talking about the wealth gap? Is that talking from a scarcity model? It's kind of hard to tell the person who lives in a food desert, who doesn't have the money for the rent, that this is just, this is a mindset.
Yes. So the thing I want to say is you're actually talking about two different things, one of which really matters. The other, I'm not so sure. My co-writer Peter Diamandis isn't so sure. So the first thing to know is we have a built-in sense of fairness, right? Like it comes built in into the brain. So any time we see these disparities, it really bugs us, right? It bugs us as people. That comes built in. Peter and I would both say, who cares how much money the person at the top has? Do I really care that Elon has $1 trillion or what? Like, not really. What I do care about, though, is what's known as the rising floor, right? I care about what's happening at the bottom of the pyramid and in the middle of the pyramid. I don't give a pardon my language, about the top of the pyramid. It doesn't matter to me. What matters is that, and this is one of the great things about technology. Technology tends to, you know, demonetize, dematerialize goods, services, things along those lines. So Ray Kurzweil used to joke about this all the time. He used to say, nobody notices progress in AI because we don't call it progress in AI. Once it's progress, we call it an ATM.
That's pretty funny. If you're just joining me on Cool Science Radio, I'm having a conversation with Stephen Kotler. He has co-written, along with Peter Diamandis, a new book called We Are As Gods. I wanted to talk to you about, maybe it's kind of the victim mindset, but it's about, you know, you talk to the software developer that lost their job, and they're convinced that all software development jobs have gone away because of AI. Just yesterday, I was talking to a young man who actually went back to business school before anything happened in his software development job. But he said that what's happening now is that there were things that were so broad. If we think about, you know, software programs that we all use, like QuickBooks or something like that, it's just so broad. Because there was no AI, now there is AI, and things can much more easily become niche products, niche software. And those things are being developed now from someone who has an abundance mindset and uses this opportunity as, you know, a creative opportunity. I'm just curious about that sort of model and how you would talk to someone about something like that, someone who lost their job.
When I think of AI and your software example and all this stuff, I think like five things I'm looking at this on. I'll start at the beginning. The first is we are hearing a lot of noise about AI. There's a tremendous amount of hype. How much is hype and how much is real is a very open question. I will point out that most of the people shouting about AI are making money off of AI. So there's the reporter in me, the old school journalist in me goes, I don't buy it. And I don't see the rate of development in the actual, I work with AI as a scientist. It's phenomenal. I work with it as a writer. It's mediocre at best. And I see all the things it fails to do in either category as often as I see the wonderful things it does. So I think there's some hype there. I will also say that you're hearing a lot, coders are losing their jobs. And one, coders always thought of themselves as having permanent jobs and being the smart people in the room. So there's two things going on here. One, they're quickly discovering that coding is a bounded knowledge base that an AI can work inside, whereas writing is an unbound knowledge base and AIs are crappy writers. Coding, it's a bounded task, and AI is phenomenal for that. So you're hearing about jobs going away from the people on the front end of it, who it didn't just like come for their job, it came for the thing they do that they were proudest of in the world. And that's a real psychological problem, but that's one of the reasons the noise is so loud. And I would also say, and I've said this for a while, I came up as a journalist and an author. My entire industry went away in 2001. The dot-com crash, we were talking about it the other day. I was making $3 a word. I was talking to a friend of mine who was making $4 a word before the dot-com crash. And literally by the Monday after the dot-com crash, I had lost the job I spent 10 years trying to get. And I was now down to like 25 cents a word. I went from 10,000 word articles to 2,000 word articles. And this was overnight. And then in 2007, the other half of my business, the publishing industry that put out books, basically got decimated. And most of the other things I do have been decimated multiple times by technology. So when I hear the coders saying this thing, I'm like, yeah, welcome to the party. We call this the 21st century. And anybody who thinks they work for a company or have job security, you're wrong. We're all freelancers now. We're all entrepreneurs. And those are the new rules. Welcome to the 21st century. It's not, I'm not trying to be a jerk here. I spent 20 years trying to become the best long-form magazine writer I could possibly be, the best in the world. And I was on staff at the magazine that hired the best writers. I got there. And then my entire, that long-form magazine journalism doesn't exist. It's not an art form anymore. I was best in the world at a thing that is gone. It's not there. And I was angry for years. One of the reasons I do a lot of the work we do now on AI and human performance, and how do you use the combination of flow and AI to reskill workers very quickly, is because I was so devastated by that. We started actually the Flow Research Collective, which does a lot of this work. It has been for a while. I founded it because I had ridden around on the first autonomous car. And back in 2008, around the Stanford campus, and what became the Google car, back when it was really more of a hypothesis, but I went, wow, it's
you were brave.
Truckers. Right, but I saw the autonomous trucks coming, and I was watching. That's the largest blue-collar workforce in America. The truck fleet currently takes 15 years to go extinct. So by around 2045, we have to reskill the largest blue-collar workforce in America, or we have a massive problem. That was the problem, one of the problems I actually came in to solve. One of We Are As Gods came out of the work the Flow Research Collective has been doing on those issues. So there's a lot of like on the how do I get a new job? Like there's really cool stuff going on. I can speak into that side of it too. There's way more development. But the final thing I want to say, and this is also true in coding, and your friend just doesn't remember it, which is if you were a coder pre-internet, right? You were like C++, you were a badass, and suddenly the internet happened. And if you didn't know COBOL or, you know, one of those other crazy languages that were really hard, Python, they were really hard to learn, like their industry shifted, right? And my point is that technology historically, and this is always, creates more jobs than it removes. And I have yet to see proof that this time is any different. I'll give you another number just to put a number on it also. 2025, which was the year that like all these fears showed up and we were hearing about why is Fred technological unemployment. I went back afterwards and I was like, okay, how many jobs did we actually lose to AI in 2025? And it was 54,000 jobs. On average, the American economy turns over almost 2 million jobs a year. Like that's how many go away and new jobs come in, or it's 1.8 million to be exact. So 54,000 is tiny. Now I'm not saying that number isn't going up, but there is a natural attrition here and new jobs pop up. And we make that point in We Are As Gods. We tell this crazy story about Ben Lamb, who's built a de-extinction company, right? He's doing de-extinction at scale. And he's, you know, had his Tasmanian tiger was on the cover of Time. Like he's done it. He's going for the dodo. He's going for the woolly mammoth. This is actually all happening. And we created a fake job board that comes off his de-extinction efforts. And like in between the time when I created that job board and today, 6 months after that, or a year later, most of those jobs exist now because his company is like, they're real. And that's sort of a point as well. So I think one, AI is slower and not as crazy. And everybody thinks LLMs can get us to super intelligence and consciousness. And I think they don't know a thing about neuroscience and they're wrong and it won't work that way. So I think it's going to be slower than most people think. And I'm a little less concerned, but what concerns me the most is the fear, because it's crippling.
Mm-hmm. Well, this, as you're talking, it's really taking shape, you know, whether you are a software developer or a journalist or a coal miner. It, you know, we talk about the need to adapt, but I don't think that's the right word. In the words that you're introducing here, like change your mindset into abundance rather than adapt. I mean, could you look at those words?
Let's actually speak into this. This is like one of the lessons we talk about. So what is being prepared for the 21st century really mean? And the most interesting thing to me is there are a bunch of so-called soft skills from the 20th century: creativity, meaning making, purpose, play, adaptive flexibility. These were soft skills in the 20th century. In fact, if you brought up most of them in a board meeting, I got out of high school in 85. Like, if I would have walked into a business meeting and been like, flow, creativity, passion, they would have laughed me out of the room, right? These are hard skills in the 21st century. And the interesting thing, I'll give you an example. So in the face of massive uncertainty, which is what we're all facing right now, one, the best thing to do is small agentic steps. If you are facing uncertainty and you want to reclaim your life, clean your desk, pull your jacket around your shoulders, take tiny steps where you take control of your life step by step by step, and will massively reduce fear. So great way to start regulating your nervous system a little bit. But uncertainty, when we're dealing with it, what we really want, and this is sort of the secret to resilience, and there's a lot of data supporting this, is adaptive flexibility. Adaptive flexibility is the ability to be creative and rise to the challenge in whatever direction we can. Here's where that gets really interesting. I work on flow, which is an optimal state of consciousness where we feel our best and perform our best. One of the things flow does is it significantly heightens adaptive flexibility. In fact, George Bonanno is the world's leading expert on resilience. When 9/11 happened, George, who's at Columbia, got the money for the healthcare of New York. So he's done the largest studies ever on resilience. He's led the largest resilience programs in history. And he has said, he actually said it on my podcast recently, or about a year ago, that there's no way to really train resilience and adaptive flexibility, but you can train flow. And because flow amplifies creativity and problem solving and decision making, all these things so far above baseline, it gives you adaptive flexibility. My lab has taken it actually farther. We discovered about 5 or 6 years ago that flow seemed to overwrite PTSD, and that was interesting. Mm-hmm. And then a friend of mine's lab found that flow will overwrite burnout. And there's new studies, really big studies that came out that show that flow is neuroprotective against depression and anxiety and all these things. And by the way, this is data that showed up in our training. We've trained flow in 156 countries, I think, in 28 industries at this point. And on average, we see after like 8 weeks of training, we can increase flow like 74%. That's cool. But there's an automatic drop in anxiety by like 40% that goes with it, which is a really sort of big deal when you're dealing with uncertainty all over the place. But it tells us that like the skills, like we're going to need these sort of skill. Flow is also how we make meaning. And one of the things that AI is doing is it's really eroding meaning, right? It's interesting. One of the key questions, I train a lot of companies to sort of harness flow and AI to really sort of up level everything they're doing. And the reason this is such a big deal, flow spikes creativity. It spikes lateral thinking, which is our ability to think outside the box, divergent thinking. And in some studies, it's 400 to 700% above baseline. That's a huge spike. AI does convergent thinking, so linear, logical problem solving. So what happens is if you can take a human and flow collaborating proper with AI, you actually get the best of both worlds. So there's a lot of edge there for humans. And so flow, this thing that was like this amorphous, weird psychological thing in the 20th century, now we have a full neurobiological map of it. We understand where it comes from, what it is, how to cultivate it, how to use, deploy it in a work environment. And it's sort of going to be mandatory if you want to collaborate with AI. In fact, this isn't in Weird as Gauze, but Peter and I, when we went around the world talking to experts about, hey, what's coming and what does preparedness look like and what should everybody know? And they're experts. So like they never agree, right? Ever, you never get experts to agree. And yet everybody we talked to agreed on basically the same thing, which is humans in flow who can collaborate with each other and with AI are going to own the future. That was a very clear sort of global conclusion for people looking at these problems. I thought that was really interesting. I think a lot of people are starting to see these things at once.
We are as gods. by my guest, Stephen Kotler, along with Peter Diamandis. Stephen, thank you so much for joining me on Cool Science Radio. This is a perfect topic for a science show.
It's a great topic for a science show. Thank you so much for having a science show. I appreciate that so much. I can't tell you.